Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Moscalzo, and we are here for our Insulin Resistance Solution Practitioner Training Rounds 3 call. And I'm excited to be here tonight to share some next steps for you to be doing, and hopefully you've had an opportunity to dig in and go into the things we have posted already on parts 1 and 2. We will have the part 3 posted probably sometime tomorrow. It might be as late as Thursday, but I just a few more touches that I want to put on the page before we get it put up. And we'll talk about it today, about all the great resources related to stress, emotions, and sleep as they affect insulin receptors, insulin resistance, and blood sugar balance. So take a deep breath. Before we begin, I'm going to make sure that you're aware that all the information that I'm presenting here and that you'll be presenting to your clients as you take them through this process is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, not intended as medical advice. It's intended as a sharing of knowledge, information from me, from my research, from my experience, from my work with patients, and lots of research on the web and in the medical journals and lots of education. And it's not intended to be a substitute for medications. If someone you're working with is diabetic, is diagnosed with a condition and is on medication, make sure that they are working in partnership with that practitioner to help them. Because as you apply these principles that you're learning, what you're going to see is people's blood sugar is starting to normalize. And what that means is that if they are on blood sugar-lowering medications, insulin or oral diabetic agents, that as they apply the things that you're going to teach them, those numbers are going to go down. And you don't want them to get in trouble by having too low a blood sugar. So they need to be making their doctor aware that they may be needing to be having multiple lowerings of their prescriptions. So just as a review, our schedule, we are tonight on call 3. We had a bonus call last week, so technically this is call 4, but that was considered a bonus call, and we just did a Q&A to allow me to recover from my elbow procedure. So today is the 17th. We actually have a break, a planned break in the schedule next week, and our following call after that is Monday, September the 30th. And then we'll have Monday, October 7th. So next week is a good opportunity for you to get caught up on all the great materials we're giving you as parts 1, 2, and 3. Watch the videos, listen to any audios, refresh yourself on these presentations. We will be getting these transcribed, and this will allow me to have some catch-up time so I can make sure that the recordings are edited properly before we send them to the transcriptionist. And then you'll be able to read back over everything that I talk about. And then we finally have a bonus call, which is more business-related, which is basically helping you to engage people in doing programs with you. And we'll be talking about that on call 5, is how to set up your own programs with people, whether it's one-on-one or in groups. And then my friend and colleague, Nina Price, who is a licensed acupuncturist but came from the corporate world, the business world, and she's going to share some of her secrets for how you can use your skills in or develop some skills in being able to engage people in marketing to get people into your practice. Because you need to be able to get out there and invite people in and have them be attracted to what you're doing in order to make serious changes. So that's going to be just an extra bonus for you. Okay, so this week, hopefully by tomorrow, Friday, the part 3 will be released, and then the week of September 30th, part 4, and then the week of October 7th, part 5. So you'll have plenty of opportunity to go through. And let's move on. If you haven't already joined the Facebook group, we haven't had a lot of activity out there. We need to get out there and just get some activity. All of you sharing from your own experience with other people, asking questions. Some people are more experienced than others. Some people have different realms of experience and expertise, and it's a great way to share. And that's my entire group, not just the insulin resistance practitioner training, but also my year-long certification training and people who went through my client assessment tools for holistic practitioners course on how to read labs and do functional assessments. So just as a review, we had our kickoff call where we went over the biochemistry, the causes of insulin resistance, some basics on testing and basics on nutrients. In part one, we went into more details on insulin resistance, including glucose testing and fitness protocols. In part two, we went into the nutrition protocols, and I give you lots of valuable information for you to go through in that part of the program. Part three this week is insulin resistance, emotion, stress, and sleep protocols. So how you identify what's going on with your clients that are insulin resistance and how their sleep patterns, how their emotional patterns, how their stress patterns contribute to that. And I'm going to share with you, I'm going to go into the depths of the biochemistry of how that works and the physiology of how that works. And you're going to be sharing with each client. You'll probably decide how much of that to share. You're going to have some of the really heavy-duty PhD, computer whiz kind of people who want to know all the details. And then you have people who just say, tell me what to do. And you'll just fill it out. I believe that it's really good to get people to understand the process, which is why I'm teaching it to you in a level of detail, and then you can choose what level of detail you want to pass that on to your clients in. Next time, part four, we're going to go into the balancing act and protocols in terms of timing and other things related to the whole thing and putting it together, and then finally, and the 30-day program, and then finally, we're going to look at holistic health coaching with this. If you're in practice, how do you take what you've learned here and create a program that you can then offer to people? And it's one thing to just say, well, you have this problem and, pay me for each visit that you come in for. It's much more attractive to a client for you to have a specific program in place and have materials and recipes and protocols that you can share with them in a cohesive way. So, we've got five key lifestyle areas that we've been talking about addressing. We addressed nutrition last week in detail, or 2 weeks ago in part two. We have the exercise, which we addressed in part one. In this part, we're going to go through the stress and the sleep, and then next time we'll go through the timing and putting it all together into a cohesive 30-day plan. The five steps, recall, we talked about we're increasing insulin sensitivity. I talked about doing that before you even get started on taking away foods that are causing them to need more insulin, and that involved using some supplements and essential oils and things like that. And we did that. We talked about that in part one. Decreasing their insulin need, we went through great detail about that last session part two, when we went through the nutrition, the nutrients, and the foods in a lot of detail. We've been talking about reducing inflammation all along by getting rid of allergens, by getting rid of foods and substances that increase that, by optimizing essential fatty acids and other nutrients that are really important in the body's inflammation pathways. And I gave you some resources for that. Optimizing lean fat burning and lean muscle mass. We're going to talk a lot about that in part three because it has a lot to do with sleep and balancing the hormones that basically, like I like to say, that dance in your sleep. And then tonight also we'll be discussing how we minimize stress, the effects of stress. I call it the candy bar eating effect of stress. And we'll talk in detail about what that means and why I believe that getting stressed out is like eating a candy bar without the fun, and that's the way that affects your whole blood glucose management system. Again, we're going through a little bit of a review. We are going to look for what we want to achieve in our clients and our patients is that they have a normal insulin response to food. When they have a normal insulin response to food, their bodies get balanced in ways that you can't even imagine in terms of their hormones, in terms of their brain capacity, in terms of their emotions, in terms of their belly fat, their physique, their ability to gain muscle and burn fat. So they eat, causes the glucose to rise, causes the pancreas to secrete insulin, causes the insulin to then escort the sugar through the cell walls into the cells where the blood glucose then decreases. The cells convert that glucose into ATP. Person feels energized. The leptin levels rise. That triggers fat burning in between meals. The pancreas stops secreting insulin. And then there's an increase in energy. The glucose is in the cells. Everybody's feeling good and happy. And then after a while, they get hungry again, they eat again, and the whole cycle goes over again. This is a process I keep going over with you because I want you to understand it and practice it well enough so that you can explain this to your clients and have them really understand it. And remember, normal blood sugar. What you'll find in the medical profession is they typically will address the first fasting blood glucose first thing in the morning. And they'll, well, you're fine. You're below 120, which is the cutoff for diabetes. Or, you're between 100 and 120, which is the range for what's considered pre-diabetes or insulin resistance. And in reality, we discovered, and we've been talking about ever since the very first session, that it's important to actually measure the blood glucose, not just upon awakening, but throughout the day. You want to measure their response to food. And we've got charts on here at the top which show the normal response of the body to food via the way that the blood glucose goes. And it starts at a level, it goes up, it peaks at somewhere between a half an hour after eating, and then comes back down. It should be back at baseline somewhere around the two-hour mark. That's what you're looking for in somebody who has a normal insulin response to food. The chart at the bottom is actually the way the body responds in terms of insulin secretion, and you can see that they parallel each other very well. So although we can't do insulin measures at home, we can do glucose measures at home, and we're expecting that that's what's going on with the insulin. Over time, when people eat too many carbs, their nutrients are out of balance, they stop doing this normal response, the curves start to look very, very different. You'll see some things way at the top which indicate abnormal responses. If you want to review this, go back to part one. I have a whole set of resources for you there and a slide presentation where I explain this whole chart and what it means and how to interpret it when you have your clients do their blood glucose testing. This is the thing that's going to set you apart from your average practitioner. Most people don't do this. They just say, oh, here's an insulin resistance diet. And what I've found is that insulin resistance diet does not necessarily work for everyone. Some people will have elevations in blood glucose at foods that are on the charts listed as low glycemic foods. And that really you want your clients and you want for yourself to really know what your own glycemic indexes are. In part two, I gave you a whole bunch of stuff about the glycemic index and some charts and some references as to where you could look those up. But know that those are just guidelines. That's not true for everyone, and that's why I'm really keen on having you teach your patients and clients how to measure their own glucose so that you do it yourself so you know how you respond to food. And the thing that affects this glucose chart dramatically, in addition to the food, is what we're going to talk about tonight, is stress and lack of sleep. It can throw these charts out the window. They won't respond the same way when a person's under stress. It can throw these things off. And we'll talk about the mechanisms for that tonight. So remember, this is how you know if somebody has insulin resistance. These are a few of the primary symptoms. Not all of the symptoms. All of the symptoms are listed in the assessment that I gave you in part one. What you can use all those questions. You can create your own nice questionnaire. You can put your own letterhead at the top and your own name and your own contact information, but you can use the information. Okay? Create your own. Belly fat, especially in people who don't have fat in other parts of their body, it's a clear indication. That person that has the hips and the waist being close to the same size or the same size, or in a lot of guys, those hips are a lot smaller than that waist because they're insulin resistant. Low energy, especially after meals, because your body can't utilize that sugar and it's going to fat stores and you eat all this food and all you're doing is feeling tired because your body's digesting. You hear that from people, you start to think insulin resistance. After a while, when you start to look for this more and more, you're going to see it much more easily, even before they fill out the questionnaire. But it's good to have them fill out the questionnaires because you want them to get the sense. You want them to see it on paper. And so it's a good idea for them to have a quantitative number, especially if you can quantify the number, like they have 75% of the symptoms, and then after you work with them, they only have 25% of the symptoms, they're going to realize how much your work has helped them. Because a lot of people have amnesia. You go through a process with them, and they forget how bad they feel at the beginning. So I'm a big fan of getting assessments and quantifying that. That mid-afternoon energy slump is a really critical piece. Really difficult focusing, difficult learning, and irritability when meals are skipped, just cranky like a little baby crying for their milk. That's what you're going to see a lot. Those are the main symptoms, and those are real flags and hallmarks. We talked about breaking the vicious cycle, that eating more carbs makes the person more hungry because it triggers a higher response of the insulin. The sugar can't get into the cells, and the body's still crying for more and more food. And it just you got to break that cycle. So they eat, their blood sugar goes up, the insulin gets released, and then produces body fat, so they're in body fat storage mode. Their sugar goes too low sometimes, then they get the cravings again. So this is the cycle we're learning to break, and you've already got some good tools under your belt to do that. We're going to talk about some more tonight. Movement. We talked about this in the first session. Why did I talk about this before I talked about the diet? Well, it's easier to tell somebody, here, take these three supplements and walk for 20 minutes a day, than it is to say, no more donuts, no more coffee, get off the alcohol, and all the restrictive type dietary things that need to happen in order to restore insulin insulin sensitivity. You're going to see on the internet, if you get on a lot of mailing lists, there's a lot of folks out there that want you to believe that you can continue to eat all of the favorite foods, including donuts and pizza, and all you need to do is pop this pill, and your blood sugar is going to stay stable and you're going to lose weight. Well, maybe you'll lose weight by other mechanisms, but it doesn't mean it's healthy. So it's really important that you learn this stuff so that you can teach them the healthy way to do it. They're going to see those same things, and they're going to be tempted. So we start where they're going to get success. We start by giving them a few of the supplements to reduce or increase the sensitivity of their cells. The cravings tend to go down. They start moving. Then you introduce some add-tos. You know, here's some nice recipes for some green soups and smoothies and salads and salad dressings and dips and things. And you get them moving in that direction. And then when they've adjusted there, then you hit them with what they need to be avoiding. The high-carb processed foods, the sugars and all their relatives. You can do the low-glycemic sweeteners. So there's a lot of recipes that you've got already in the Before Be Gone booklet. You can share with people. You can make them. You can make your own versions of them. Okay, you can't share the entire book with people, but you can pull recipes and you know, the ones that you like, that you think people are going to like, and give them recipes. Just give me credit for the recipes if you're using them exactly. Get them off the flour, the crackers, the pasta, the bread. Simple stuff. And a lot of the insulin resistance programs you're going to see will continue to include some of these things in them. And that might be okay for a lot of the people. Not everybody's extremely sensitive. That's where you are differentiated, because you're going to teach them how to test. And if they can get away with rice and it keeps their blood glucose nice and low, great. But if that doesn't work, then you get them off of that, and you do that over time, and you get them on a 30-day metabolic reset, as I like to call it. Getting them off the legumes unless the glucose curve is normal. Many, if not most people, do fine with things like black beans. But I've worked with people, and they say, well, black beans and lentils work fine, but white beans and garbanzo beans don't. So that's the stuff that you want to find out in each individual person that you're working with. The potatoes, I say, go, because they're just over and over again high glycemic. They stimulate it. But I have had a few people who say, well, I can eat a potato and my blood sugar only goes up to 98. Fine. Okay, just watch them over the long haul. Remember, we taught you how to look at it over the 3-hour, 4-hour, 5-hour to make sure that that potato is not triggering a hypo or reactive hypoglycemia, because it's over-secreting, your body's over-secreting the insulin. That happens sometimes. But a lot of people, yams and sweet potatoes and squash may be okay, although I talked to somebody yesterday. She says, I tried again with winter squash. It doesn't work for me. So then they have to stay away from it. So that's where the testing comes in. When you have somebody who doesn't want to test, remember I said just put them on the strictest regime possible, get them to stay there for 3 to 4 weeks, and then see how they're doing in terms of their other signs and symptoms. Redo the insulin resistance questionnaire. Ask them about their mid-afternoon fatigue. See if their waistline is going down. I like to get people off of all the high glycemic, high sugar fruits like mangoes, pineapple, papaya, those sorts of things. Some people can tolerate them. Some people can't, but you definitely don't want them to have the dried versions of that because those are definitely sweeter. And the fruit juices, all gone. Even if it's fresh squeezed orange juice, it may be a disaster for someone with insulin resistance. And finally, I prefer that they stay off of all heated oils and fats. If they really insist and they want to do stir fries and you want to go for it with them, just with coconut oil or olive oil, not high heat, just moderate heat. But it's really best to avoid oxidized fats because they damage those insulin receptors, remember? And small quantities of low glycemic fruits like berries or based on their testing are often okay. But again, I like to limit those to one or two a day because it's very easy for those to trigger cravings again and throw everybody off before they realize it. Then we have the balancing the omega-3s. I gave you some resources last week in part two where you have the omega-3 6 chart and you can have people give you their numbers and you can track them and say, hey, you're eating too much omega-6. Remember, omega-6 can be inflammatory and can affect the insulin receptors. So very small amounts and good omega-3 type sources. I like to use coconut mixed with my other omega-3 sources like the chias and flax and hemp and walnuts because it helps with the conversion of those to the long-chain fats like DHA, EPA. And in that chart that I gave you, the spreadsheet, there are about 3 to 5 really well-balanced omega-6-3 recipes. What you'll find is a lot of people who, as they start to change their diet, and some people get worse in terms of their insulin resistance when they go from, say, a standard American diet where they're eating a lot of meat and potatoes, and then they go to, say, a whole foods raw diet, but they're eating a lot of dried fruits and nut combinations and olive oil and everything, and it can really throw them off. So it's you. You're going to be the detective. You're going to be the blood sugar detective to really figure out what's going on there and help them to fine-tune that diet. And I highly recommend that you do this first. That you go through this first, which is why I included the Before Be Gone program as a part of your program, and that's going to start right after, like the week after this program ends. It might even be the same week that this program ends. So glucose balancing beverages, these are nice. I gave you a whole recipe guide for these. Help people to stay steady throughout the day. They can drink water with little essential oils and use some of the essential oils that help balance the blood sugars. These are some of those beverages. It's just a review from last time. And then finally, as much organic as possible because the pesticides and the herbicides that are used on the food and the GMOs in the food, they affect the way the liver metabolizes. They affect, and the liver's critical organ in blood sugar balance, plus it affects those receptors on each cell. And so you want to make sure they're organic as much as possible. And then what you're going to have them do in terms of their diet for 30 days is lots of vegetables, raw or cooked, unlimited quantities, the non-starchy vegetables. If they can keep their blood sugars under 110 with blueberries, apples, grapefruit, they can eat those during the process. But I've had people have their blood sugars go up to 185 with the grapefruit. So really be careful with that. Raw nuts, most people don't have a problem with raw nuts. Should have them soaked and rinsed just because it makes them more digestible. Things like coconut, most people can do unlimited, although the raw coconuts with the water oftentimes raises people's blood glucose. So be careful about that before you just allow them to have that. You may find that they're not getting the results and it's a matter of their sugars going up from the coconut water. Raw seeds, especially the high omega-3 ones like chia, flax, and hemp. If they are not vegetarian, they want to eat some animal products, it needs to be either cold water fish caught in clean oceans, organic free-range meat, or wild game. they can do it with that, the program will work, and they can definitely do it as a vegan, the program will work. There's a lot of propaganda out there that says we have to eat animal products to be healthy, and then there's a lot of people saying, well, you can't be healthy if you do eat animal products. I think if it's moderation and there's small amounts, for a lot of people it works just fine. So you just have to feel your person out as to what extent they're going to go with. I see a lot of people who come to me and say, well, I went to this doctor, they wanted to do this, and I said the only way I can do it is if I stop being vegan and start eating animal protein, and I don't believe that that's true. We work with people to help their balances. If it turns out that it is true, I will tell them, but I will work with them with their belief systems and help them to do it in a way that's balanced and keeps it together. I find that some of the other insulin resistance programs out there, if you are vegan or vegetarian, it's really hard to follow their diets because there's meat at every meal. And then you have to kind of make up your own. In mine, there's no meat at any meal, but I give people who want the meat the option of just make this this veggie dish and then add 3 ounces of some sort of very high-quality animal protein. So that's where it's different. So you can really help these people by having the right recipes. And then the foods that they eat cautiously, we've talked about this before, the high water content, the legumes, the starchy seeds, just make sure that they're testing before they go ahead and use them. And if they're not wanting to poke their finger, that's fine. You just give them the strictest form of the insulin resistance diet for 30 days. Doesn't mean they have to stay on this forever. You're going to be testing, and we'll share with you how to test them in next week's session. The meal timing, again, we'll go through this more as today. Tonight we're going to talk about leptin, and this is really important for the leptin insulin levels, but no snacking. Don't allow them to get famished. Some people will go, oh, no, I have to go 6 hours between meals, and then they're, like, irritable and cranky and having heart palpitations. It's working with them to help them extend the time to, between meals to where they can be comfortable. You can't take somebody who has reactive hypoglycemic, and needs to eat every 2 hours and immediately get them eating at 6 hours. But you can wean them there. And I've had people who have just done the timing things. They were too busy to start all the other pieces of it. They just started spacing their meals out. The weight started to come off. The energy started to come back. Okay, so there's a lot to this. No eating at night. No high carbohydrate breakfast. Remember we talked about that in part two. When you eat carbs in the morning, it throws off your leptin curve. And we're going to look at some leptin charts tonight, and you'll see that it's really important to stay away from those carbs because it causes your leptin to peak much earlier in the day and then drop. And when leptin levels drop, that's when you start to get cravings. And that's where people just can't stand it after dinner. They're just starving. They feel like they have to eat. It's because of those leptin levels dropping. Eating protein within an hour of waking helps a lot of people. There are some people who do better by skipping breakfast, believe it or not. I know that might be heresy to some of you, but some people do better that way. Some people, eating that protein within an hour of getting up helps maintain cortisol levels and insulin levels and leptin levels throughout the day. And then gradually increasing the meal spacing, and you'll work with them at their own pace to do that. But try it yourself because you're going to get a feel for what your body's going through. If it's going through withdrawals, then you're going to be able to better empathize with people. When I first did this program, or I've done this program individually with people for years, for 20 years. I've been putting people on a program like this. But when I decided to put it all down on paper and create a group program and take a group through, I went through it myself, and there were a lot of surprises, and it was quite interesting for me to go through it, and I was able to share my experiences with them and really empathize. So that's our review, okay? That's where I came to, and now let's go and move into insulin resistance, emotions, stress, and sleep protocols. Most people think that these are just the woo-woo parts of it, right? Just make sure that you get them exercising and make sure you get them eating properly. That's the typical mainstream approach, and that'll solve the problem. And it doesn't. And in a lot of cases, it's because the emotions, stress, and sleep are way off. For me, when I first discovered I had insulin resistance, I looked and I said, how can I possibly have insulin resistance? I've been eating this pristine diet for the last 25 years. I eat tons of greens. I exercise. I'm really good at stress management. And then I looked and went, oh, I haven't gotten more than 3 hours of sleep in the last few months. Oh, that could cause it. So I'll go through and share some of the studies related to sleep and the mechanisms and all the hormones that come out and play. And I'm giving you an overview tonight. And on the site, you're going to have detailed, there's a couple of detailed papers and a couple of detailed slide presentations that are going to go through this in more detail. We talk about sleep cycles and how you can help people to really normalize their sleep patterns. So stress and insulin resistance. We're going to talk about what stress is and how it affects health and weight. We're going to talk about the importance of using goals and visions to help people make health-supporting choices every day. When people don't really know what's important to them, they just make haphazard choices. And I'm sure you've been there, right? You don't really, maybe I'll skip gluten today. Maybe I'll have toast because I'm out with my boyfriend and he's having this amazing toast and I'll just eat it. It's no big deal. When you when you're really connected to the outcome and what you want, you're going to make good choices. And that's what you can work with people on right from the start. Taking stress transformation breaks in 1 to 2 minute intervals. And we'll talk about heart math and some of the wonderful techniques there. And I've given you lots of resources on your site. Noticing and celebrating positive aspects. I have a document that I'm giving you that you can use with people called the Positive Aspects Journal. It's something that I learned a few years back that I found really helpful for people to start to focus on the positive, which shifts their nervous system from sympathetic to parasympathetic, where healing happens. We'll give you some resources for emotional eating patterns, because you're going to see a lot of people come in and they don't eat for nourishment. They eat because it's an entertainment factor or because it's an emotional response. And I give you a document in the site that will help you to help other people create an emotional eating pattern for themselves. The importance of fun as a regular part of their health regime. We all are guilty of overlooking that. And periodically throughout the day, I'll say, okay, I'm just going to go outside and I'm going to put my feet in the hot tub. And I'm going to just sit and stare at the sun for 5 minutes. And that I consider fun. Or take out, a puzzle and do a puzzle. And teaching people to take that time, even if it's 3 to 5 minutes a day, it's going to shift their physiology. We're also going to talk about the power of appreciation to transform health challenges, achieve ideal weight, energize and revitalize self. So let's begin. So what really is stress? We all think about stress as this bad thing. It's used to describe the wear and tear the body experiences in reaction to everyday tensions and stresses and pressures. When the demand on the body or on the psyche exceeds the capacity to respond, that's considered a stress. But there are good stresses, right? You go out to the gym and you pick up a weight and you start to do bicep curls with it and you get to about 8 of them and you just can't go any further and you have to stop. You just put a stress on that muscle, right? You took it to fatigue. What happens? It responds. It reacts by strengthening. So over several weeks of doing that, you're going to be able to lift more and more and more. So there's good stress. The stresses that are damaging are the stresses that exceed the capacity to respond without replenishing and rebuilding. Okay. So where does it all begin? And this is critical. A lot of folks, especially if you're new in practice, you're going to jump in and you want to use all the great nutrition techniques you've learned to teach people recipes and put them on supplements and herbs. Really has to start with alignment, and I like to call it a head-heart habits approach. You want to align your head and your heart, and that makes the habits just flow. If you start with habits, like, oh, I'm going to give up gluten, and oh, I'm going to, exercise every day, but you don't have your head and your heart aligned with that, it very quickly goes by the wayside. You're going to see that a lot with your clients, right? You get all excited, and then they say, yeah, tell me what to do, and you tell them what to do, and then they start doing it, and a couple of weeks later, something better comes along. They have a wedding. Their sister gets married. Their daughter has a birthday, and they go, it's just okay to eat the chocolate cake today, because their head and their heart were not aligned with that new habit of not eating chocolate cake and eating, lots of veggies and fruits instead. The experience that you have plus the beliefs equals the thoughts. So if somebody's had an experience really early on of being soothed by food, of every time they fell, grandma gave them a lollipop, then every time they hurt themselves emotionally or physically, they're going to turn to food, a lollipop, M&M's, bakery bread, whatever, to soothe. And that's the basis upon which their thoughts come, what they believe. Wow, food heals my pain. So that triggers a thought. So when they start to have pain, they're going to reach for food to soothe it. The thoughts also trigger an emotion. So when you think about something as being, oh, that's so bad, that's going to trigger an emotion of sadness or fear. Instead of thinking as something, you think about something, oh, wow, that was really fun, that was really good, that's going to trigger emotion, an emotion of joy, a positive emotion. Your emotions and thoughts are energy, and really clarifying that with people. When they have thoughts or emotions, it's an energy exchange. And certain emotions will benefit the physiology, like joy, bliss, gratitude. It benefits the physiology. And we'll talk about some of the hormonal changes that it causes. And others harm it, and it's through molecular changes. So when you can help people to change their thoughts and their emotions, the habits can just happen. They're not going to, it's not like putting a monkey wrench in there and trying to force it to happen. So the new ones, the new habits can replace the old destructive habits when you have the head and the heart aligned. The desire for something and the thoughts about it. It's too hard to make diet changes, you might hear someone say. That thought is going to trigger an emotion of resistance, of fear, of sadness if they have to change their diet or do some things that they haven't been doing before. It's too hard is a belief. And a lot of people hold that belief. And sometimes I'll just say, huh, well, what would it be like for you if it wasn't so hard? And they go, oh, wow, it'd be great, and I would this. And I'm like, wow, okay. What if you could decide that it's really not hard? Which is harder, getting your chest cracked open to replace valves and vessels in your heart because of a clog, as a result of your poor diet and lifestyle choices? Which is harder, that or choosing the salad over the pizza? Which is harder? Personally, I'll take choosing the salad over the pizza any day as opposed to getting my chest cracked open. But you're going to deal with people in different phases of their belief system, and it's up to you to really work with them at the start, and that's going to set you apart as well. You're not jumping in and just giving them a list of things to do and things to take. A little stress causes you to have an energy boost. Oh, you're pushed in terms of working towards your goal. But that chronic, day in, day out, have long-term and short-term health consequences. Some people, it's their immune system starts to fail. With others, it's the blood pressure goes up, hardening of the arteries, right? Decreased function of various organs. And it can permanently compromise the health and accelerate their aging and throw off their whole blood sugar mechanism, which creates a whole bunch of problems. And we'll look at the details on that. So the body reacts when there's stress. There's a feeling of tension, of strain, sometimes frustration. Muscles might tighten, you know, in the neck and in the abdomen and the chest. And heart rate for sure increases, and that's a result of the secretion of hormones, cortisol and adrenaline. Perspiration increases. Again, cortisol and adrenaline cause that. The logical thought process is replaced by irrational and unreasonable thoughts when you're under stress. And so that's the time when people make the poorest lifestyle and food choices as well. But what's called, what I like to refer to as the lizard brain, which is the back part of the brain, the primitive brain, gets control to get you out of the trouble. That's the lizard. It just knows how to fight or flight. And it takes control over the prefrontal cortex. Cortisol inhibits the prefrontal cortex. So if you're stressed because you're going into an important meeting and you have to perform, or because you're going in to take a test and you don't do some techniques to shift yourself out of that stress mode, you're dooming yourself, because your high-level functioning is not going to kick in and work. Everything gets disrupted. Your physiology, your psychology, everything gets disrupted. Equilibrium goes, you're off kilter. you feel kind of weird. And when this happens on a regular basis and continues over time, you're going to have things, failure of different systems. And you're going to see that in your clients. And when you can get them under control, when you can use the emotional piece to help them to make the right choices about what they eat and drink and how they breathe and how they move, then they're going to get the results that they need. They're going to follow through because it makes sense to them. So let's talk a little bit about cortisol. Cortisol is a stress hormone. When you get a response, like there's a fear, there's a tiger chasing you, you are going to have this response where your body at first produces adrenaline and then follows up with cortisol. Adrenaline is really quick. It's a neurotransmitter, quick in and out, quick in and out. It can be continued to be secreted, but generally the cortisol comes in and lasts longer. Cortisol's job, one of its jobs is to increase the blood sugar. So when you have someone sitting at their desk and the boss is yelling at them and they're getting stressed or they have a deadline or they just heard from the child's teacher that the child failed a test or the financial situation has changed and they're getting stressed sitting at the desk, the cortisol increases the blood sugar. But guess what? There's no activity to go with that. If there really was a tiger chasing you, you'd run and get rid of that sugar in the blood. So instead, that increased blood sugar goes through the same process as if you've just eaten a meal. And if there's a dysfunction there, if there's insulin resistance there, when you get stressed, you're increasing your blood sugar, which is going to increase the storage of belly fat because you're not burning it. It's going to thicken the artery walls, like we talked about in one of our first presentations. It's going to increase the blood pressure and keep it there. It's going to turn down the digestive tract, close the valves, decrease the enzymatic secretions. And so you've got a lot of dysfunction that occurs as a result of cortisol because cortisol is only supposed to be going up for short bursts, not a long period of time. And when we do it all the time, and when your patients are doing this all the time, they're affecting their blood sugar mechanism. When cortisol goes and looks for storage of sugar to pull out into the blood, it likes the process called gluconeogenesis instead of lipolysis or lipolysis. I like to say lipolysis. Some people say lipolysis. Lipolysis or lipolysis is the breakdown of fat. So you turn fat into sugar and put it in the blood. Cortisol favors breaking down muscle protein tissue via gluconeogenesis, and it actually can reduce the rate of fat burning. So it's a double whammy. So it converts your protein in your muscles and your connective tissue to glucose and glycogen, which is one of the reasons that when people go on corticosteroids for any length of time, they end up with muscle thinning, tissue weakening. So serious side effect. Well, if you have someone who's under stress all the time and they're constantly upping their levels of cortisol, the same situation is going to happen in their body. Their immune system is going to be depleted. The muscles are going to thin, and they're going to have problems. Okay? It also decreases bone formation. A lot of people don't realize this. So it can create and enhance the process of osteoporosis or osteopenia, a lot of stress. So this is something you want to help people get under control, right? Why would you want to ignore this piece and just talk to them about the food? What you might find is somebody comes in and their diet isn't all that bad, but the stress levels. And I'll just tell you a short personal story about cortisol. When I had my elbow surgery and they had to cut into me a 5-inch incision and cut all the way to the bone and cut bone off and put it in the right place, that's a pretty serious stress on my body. Even though I was meditating and doing heart math and keeping my mental and emotional state in a good place, the physical trauma was creating the stress in my body. My adrenals could not differentiate between a tiger biting open my elbow or a surgeon who knew what he was doing repairing my elbow. It's still the same thing. It's cutting of the tissue. It's trauma. And as a result, when I got back after the surgery, all I'd had was about 8 ounces of green juice, pure green, no sugar, no fruit, just no carrots, no beets, just kale, celery, cucumber, and ginger juice. And 8 ounces of that over time, sipped very slowly. I took my blood sugar. It was 147. I decided to eat an avocado to get it down. It was still in the 140s to 170s all day long. Why? It had nothing to do with food. It had everything to do with stress. Had I been able to measure my cortisol levels, I wish there was a home test for cortisol levels that would so empower so many people, wouldn't it? I would have found that my cortisol levels were high. Even though I was laying there and breathing and appreciating and meditating and doing things to relax my psyche, the cortisol was coursing through my system because I just got bit by a tiger. I didn't just have a tiger chasing me that day. I got bit. So it's really important for us to monitor this and approach this. Don't make the mistake of just jumping right into, here's some exercises, here's some diet, let's see how you do. Somebody's coming in and you're looking at their diet plan and the diet looks pretty darn good, then you got to look at the stress. I've had people in my Before Be Gone program and people I've coached privately who've told me that they were going along, blood sugars are perfect, and they just finished their smoothie, which they had before, that only raised their blood sugar to 98, and then they got a phone call, and it was a stressful phone call, and they decided after that, right after the smoothie, the phone call, they tested their blood sugar, and they were like, oh my God, how did my blood sugar get up to 140? Why? Because they got really stressed. And you can help people to use all the tools that you have. She was smart. She thought about, what have I done? What have I learned? I'm going to go out and do some burst training. So she did some burst training. She did a walk around the block. She came back and her blood sugar got normal again. So these are things you can teach people. I had people do heart math. I had somebody's blood sugar go down 100 points right there in front of me by taking her through heart math. So let's go through, let's review some of the interactions with cortisol and some of the other hormones. Stress causes the release of cortisol. Within about 30 minutes, the cortisol should break down into the building blocks for DHEA, because DHEA and cortisol have the same building blocks. But if the stress is prolonged, that doesn't happen. So what happens is the DHEA suffers. So if you keep thinking the stressful thoughts that trigger the response, the cortisol just keeps persisting. And healing is inhibited because DHEA is a healing. It's a growth and repair hormone. And when you're stealing the precursors away, you're sacrificing the DHEA for the cortisol. And the cortisol has all those negative effects, so it causes your body to break down. It's also the same precursors for cortisol as for your sex hormones. So that's another important piece of this. So if your person is under stress a lot, they may find that their libido is down. That's a clear sign. So in addition to all the stuff with bone and blood sugar and collagen formation, libido is a biggie too. So let's talk about how stress affects insulin resistance, the insulin receptors. The stress increases the cortisol and the adrenaline. The preferred stress fuel is glucose, not fat, not glycogen. They want glucose, and the fat can be converted, the muscle can be converted into glucose easily. Branch chain amino acids get converted more easily into sugar than does the fat, so the cortisol favors the breakdown of muscle, as we've already talked about. It's easy source of protein. It's quick, it's easy, raises the sugar pretty quickly. That's another reason people think, well, when they just eat protein, why would their blood sugar go up? And it can go up because the protein can be converted into sugar. So once the sugar goes up, of course, like we know, insulin gets secreted. And when the insulin gets secreted, but you're not burning that sugar, the sugar sits in the cells, more in the bloodstream, more insulin gets secreted, you end up with hyperinsulinemia, and eventually chronic stress will lead you to insulin resistance. Cortisol and insulin are at war with each other because insulin's job is to decrease blood sugar, right? Right? You eat something, you have a meal, insulin says, come on, bring it down. Cortisol's job is to provide fuel and increase the blood sugar. Once you have the insulin in the system, it's going to block the release of fuel from the cells. So it's going to make it difficult to break down, especially break down fat, which is why cortisol is able to get to the muscle and break that down. You need a lot more fuel when you have cortisol. So the effect of these war, this civil war between insulin and cortisol, is that you have this gnawing craving for carbohydrates. It's like, I just need some sugar right now. Have you ever experienced that? Have you ever spoken to clients that have experienced that? I just need sugar right now. And it is especially prominent a couple of hours after the meal. So this is where you want to be intervening. Not just with the meal. Of course, you want to do all the diet things we talked about last time. But it's very important that you manage the stress. DHEA has the opposite effect. DHEA actually helps to decrease both visceral, meaning around the organs, and subcutaneous, under the skin, abdominal fat. And it significantly increases the sensitivity of the cells. So if someone is adrenally fatigued and their DHEA levels are low, that's going to impact the improvement that they're going to get by doing an insulin resistance reset program. So we have to make sure that their DHEA is good. That's why I put DHEA on the list of things that are helpful to test. And you could test DHEA in the bloodstream, DHEA sulfate, or you can test it in the saliva. And I would recommend that people who have problems with insulin resistance also get an adrenal stress test, because you can work the two at the same time. This was a study in JAMA, double-blind placebo-controlled study in JAMA that talked about the significance of DHEA in increasing insulin sensitivity. So how does stress increase belly fat? Well, this is another JAMA study from 2004. Chronic stress increases cortisol, decreases DHEA, triggers the breakdown of muscle into blood sugar, increases insulin. Insulin inhibits fat burning, accelerates fat storage, and then DHEA significantly decreases subcutaneous fat and increases insulin sensitivity. So the decrease in DHEA affects this whole thing, and you end up with more belly fat. So what are you going to do about it? You need tools. Now, whatever tools you use to decrease stress are fine. I give you some tools here. It doesn't mean you have to use just my tools. Maybe you're a yoga instructor. Maybe you're a Tai Chi instructor. Maybe you've been trained in some really cool stress management system, tapping, or there's one called the work, or there's so many things that can help. It's finding the stuff that you can, that you're comfortable teaching and that your clients are comfortable receiving. And it may be different for each person. I teach HeartMath a lot, and some people just don't resonate with HeartMath. I teach them tapping. That works better for them. The whole idea, though, is that you want them to build their emotional energy reserves so that every little stress is not tapping in and leaving them exhausted. You want to plug the emotional drains. And that's, you know, that's a process too. And that's either you can work with somebody or refer them to another practitioner if it's really serious that can help them. What do I mean by plugging the emotional drains? Well, there's a lot of times there's relationships that may be happening that are draining you emotionally. Like going to visit mom and mom just starts in with criticizing your hair and your makeup and your nails and your weight and the whole bit. It's not a positive thing. And either the person needs to learn ways to protect from that energy or stay out of it and old emotional habits. These are all processes that you take people through. And this is not a shortcut thing. You can be doing this concurrently with the food. You don't have to do these things sequentially, but I highly recommend that you don't skip this part. So some of the antidotes to stress that I really like. Appreciation. Just playing the appreciation game. Every time you go to a new room, you find three things to appreciate. You find yourself finding things to appreciate in every step along the way. I like what I call mini vacations, and it's really a technique. It's a kind of a slight modification of a technique from HeartMath called quick coherence. And basically, I have people get into the mode of hand over their heart. I like to put the other hand over the belly, take some deep breaths, and go on vacation. Find a place where you just feel so good. It could be a waterfall. It could be a beach. It could be the mountains, wherever you feel just really safe and connected, and you breathe. We did this on one of our calls before. I'm not going to take the time right this second now. We'll do it towards the end. I want to make sure I get through everything. Helping them to build fun into their life, helping them to build high self-esteem, and I've given you resources for all of this. The self-esteem thing is there, the Positive Aspects Journal. And there's a whole document on the site that's going to help guide you through this. Some of these techniques you're going to love, you're going to resonate with, you'll do. Others you're just going to not do. And you're going to have to do them yourself to feel comfortable with them before you're comfortable teaching them. But remember, what works for you may not work for others. Yoga, meditation, tapping, EFT, those are all techniques to help antidote the stress, help to transform the stress in the moment. So the stuff that I've given you some of my goal-setting resources, some of the processes and the forms that I use with people to help them to set their goals and get really connected to what they want most, and that helps them with their habits. I've got my own little system of stress transformation. You've got that as a bonus on the call, on the program, with its 30 days of stress transformation. I will be making that available as a product as soon as we get some free cycles to be able to do that. So if you really like it and you want your client to do it, you could sign up as an affiliate and you can send them there, and then you'll get a percentage of whatever they pay for it. So it's actually a way to increase your income as well as get the process and not have to do the whole thing yourself. There's a book on heart math, Transforming Stress. It's a little $11 book. You can refer people to that. There's a lot of ways that you can teach them these things. I'm giving you something called the Portable Anchor System, which helps people to stay connected to their goals. The Positive Aspects Journal, which helps them to just really focus on all the things that they like about themselves and to bring up their self-esteem, which helps to reduce stress. An Emotional Eating Strategies document I've got. I've got the Healing Power of Fun and Appreciation document, and then another document called Emotional Landscape. So basically, I've provided you with a set of tools that I use. Do I use every single one of these on every single person? No. I just pick and choose. Some people, we do go through them all. And some people resonate more with one than the other. And if I give them one and they just don't seem to resonate, then I'll share a different tool. I just think that the more they're doing to transform that internal environment and take them away from being a high stress, always, you know, getting on their own case, into really loving themselves, enjoying life, and looking at the bright side, that's going to help them tremendously to overcome their insulin resistance. There's something I teach called the emotional landscape. It's interesting because I was teaching something very similar to this before I even went to HeartMath to learn it. I didn't have this little chart. I would just teach people about, you know, the effects of cortisol and the effects of DHEA and how we want to move them. And I love this because this lays it out. Any time during the day, you, your client, all of us are going to be in one of these states. And we could be in the high energy negative emotions, which are anger and rage and all those sorts of things, or the high energy positive emotion, which is just bliss and joy and excitement and exuberance. We can be in low energy negative emotions of frustration and helplessness and powerlessness and depression. Or the low energy positive emotions where you go sometimes when you're in yoga or meditation, where it's just calm and tranquil. And as much as possible, you want to keep out of the negative emotions, but it's going to happen, right? Something's going to happen that's going to get you angry. And it's learning techniques to shift you from the negative emotions into the positive emotions. Okay, and on the side of the positive emotions, DHEA flourishes. On the side of negative emotions, cortisol flourishes. And we want a balance between high energy and low energy. If you're always in the state of just excitement and, you're just up there, that's going to be draining on the body as well. You want to balance that with the calm states and the tranquility states. Being on a roller coaster all day long, maybe it feels great, but not all day long, it's going to wear you out. So it's finding a balance between high and low energy on the positive side. When you teach people about this, they can actually plot their emotions and see where they find themselves most of the time, and you can teach them to shift, and that's going to help their stress levels dramatically. So that's the stress stuff. You've got a lot of resources to explore on the site. Again, those resources should be available very shortly for you to explore. It's really, really important. But equally important is sleep. When people don't get enough sleep, they do not flourish. And I'll share with you some studies that talk about sleep deprivation and its effect on blood sugar balancing, on insulin, and on hormones in general. So we'll talk about the effect of sleep deprivation on hormones, mental function, blood sugar metabolism, energy, and weight. When you don't sleep enough, the hormones are out of balance. We'll talk about the specifics. And you put on weight. You're hungry, more hungry the next day when you don't get a good night's sleep. And insulin resistance increases. We'll talk about giving you tools that you can use with your people on adopting a bedtime ritual that encourages sound sleep, herbs, activities, things like that. There's a whole regime, and I'm sharing all that with you. I like you to understand the sleep cycles a little bit, and you can share as much or as little of it with your clients as you need to, but actually choosing a bedtime that optimizes the sleep duration. Sometimes we think that just going to bed earlier is going to give us more sleep, but it actually depends on what time you have to get up and the length of your sleep cycles. And I'll share a little bit with that, and I have a whole document for you to read the details on. Understanding the hormone interactions during sleep. This is critical. And there's a lot of them. We just think, melatonin, right? That's the important hormone while you sleep. Melatonin, good for deep sleep. Well, no, I have a whole chart and list, and I'll go through those and how those work. And I've got more information on the site that you can get more details. And then optimizing those hormones during sleep helps you to maintain steady blood sugar throughout the night, which will help you sleep, and then throughout the next day. Also helps with mental clarity, fit body, and high energy. We'll talk about all those things and how they put together. So let's talk about a few sleep facts. You may have seen these before, but a duration of sleep between 1910 and 1960 was 9 hours. How many people do you know that get 9 hours of sleep? If you ask your client on the first consultation, how much sleep do you get? You're generally going to get below 8. This says the current average is 7.5, but a lot of people get way less than that. In fact, it's estimated that about a third of the population sleeps 6 hours or less. And shift workers, nurses and other people that work shifts, less than 5 hours per workday. They may catch up a little bit on the weekend, but less than 5 hours. And this has devastating effects on the health and on insulin. So some other things. It's estimated that 70% of Americans are sleep deprived. Some have trouble falling asleep. Some have trouble staying asleep. So as you're working with somebody and asking them about their sleep, it's worthwhile to help to look at those factors and to help them to not only get to sleep but to stay asleep. One of the most common causes of being tired is lack of sleep. You know, people come and see you, they go, oh, I'm so tired, and I just need my energy back, and what herb do you have for that? What food do you have for that? What magic bullet do you have for that? And in reality, you ask them about their sleep. How much sleep do you get? Oh, you know, 3.5, 4 hours a night, sometimes 6. You know, it's broken. I wake up every couple hours. No wonder they're tired. It's not rocket science why they would be tired if they're not getting enough sleep. So it really needs to be addressed as an underlying cause of fatigue. According to Mark Hyman, he's an integrative medicine practitioner, MD. He says the most important thing you can do for your health is to have enough sleep. Not just one of the most important things, but he feels it's the most important thing. You get an imbalance between a lot of hormones, including melatonin and growth hormone. And that can actually lead to growth and repair stunting and slower healing. So sleep is critical for so many things, and it's so overlooked. So what are some of the benefits? And this, many, most of these are related to the whole insulin resistance problem that we're talking about. Fat burning. When your cortisol is lower and your leptin's higher, you burn fat more. That's what happens when you get sufficient sleep. When you sleep enough, you get enhanced production of growth hormone and DHEA. What are they responsible for? Growth and repair. And growth hormone helps with fat burning. And we just learned a few minutes ago that DHEA helps improve insulin sensitivity. So overall, they both help with fat burning, lean muscle mass, growth, and repair. And when you don't get enough sleep, you don't get the spike of growth hormone. There's one big spike right at the beginning of the night. Usually it doesn't happen if you get to bed after midnight. And that's when a lot of the growth and repair happens. So if you're exercising, or if somebody that says, I exercise like crazy, I'm lifting all these weights, but I'm not getting any stronger, I'm not building any muscle mass, you might be thinking, maybe I have a growth hormone problem. We'll talk about ways to optimize it. Sleep enhances focus and attention. They found that people who have enough sleep, they've done studies with kids and given them tests, and adults and given them tests on not enough sleep and more sleep, and sure enough, they can stay on task and they can stay focused better. While you sleep, your body's engaged in detoxification and metabolic waste removal. What does that have to do with insulin resistance? A lot, because it's metabolic waste and toxins that damage your insulin receptors in addition to the high levels of insulin. Enhanced learning, memory, and creativity. There's a part of your brain called the hippocampus that gets damaged by stress, and it gets repaired during sleep. Sleep improves insulin sensitivity. There have been many studies that showed that when you skip sleep or you have a low level of sleep, even for one night, the next day you're more insulin resistant. Now think about that happening over and over again. It creates insulin resistance. It's where I hurt myself with lack of sleep. Not that I couldn't sleep, it's just that I chose not to because I felt like I had too much energy. It decreases cancer risk because melatonin protects against cancer, and we need to have melatonin. We need to have melatonin and growth hormone in balance. And we're going to learn ways that eating before bedtime affects those hormones and how it's dangerous not just for the insulin resistance and lack of growth hormone, but also for melatonin and increasing the risk of cancer. Sleep enhances your serotonin production and reduces depression. It also reduces inflammation. They found that with C-reactive protein, a measure of inflammation in the blood, is a lot higher when people get less than 6 hours sleep. And that can lead to inflammation of the arteries, heart disease, autoimmune disease, joint issues. And finally, sleep helps endurance and stamina. When they do studies with athletes and they check how well they perform on days after a good night's sleep versus a shorter night's sleep, far outweighs on the days they get better sleep, their endurance and stamina. So there's a lot of reasons, and you may share some of these with your clients, you know, the ones that are going to be most important to them. If they value the brain function and memory, and they're really concerned about their loss of memory, you cook it in there. If they're an athlete and they're wanting to build that lean body and have good endurance, but they're finding they don't have as much as they want, you can focus on that. Use these to help you to get people to make the changes they need to make. It's not manipulation, it's education. So just a few more things just to get you convinced. Nurses and shift worker studies, they all find that there's a higher incidence of heart disease. Sleep deficits lead to performance loss, slowed reaction time, impaired memory, and decreased motivation. The uptake of glucose in the brain drops by as much as 7% with sleep deprivation. And your brain is a big part of the uptake of glucose. And they're finding that insulin resistance and poor glucose uptake in the brain contributes to Alzheimer's and other degenerative brain diseases, neurodegenerative diseases. And finally, one sleepless night can induce insulin resistance in healthy people. I went researching this when I first found out that I had insulin resistance, and I discovered an enormous number of studies related to this. And I have on the page, you're going to have a whole list of various studies if you want to go deeper and really study this further. I've done that work for you, but I also know that you may want to dig, especially if it's something that's close to home or you need more evidence to convince somebody. So let's take a brief look at the 5 stages of sleep. I go into this in a lot more detail on the site. There's a paper about this. Stage 1 is that light sleep. It's when you first go to sleep, but also transitioning between sleep cycles. If you sleep through the night, you know, say you go to bed and you wake up, you go to bed at 10 and you wake up at 7, that bunk of time was not just one, like you fell asleep and you just slept all the way through. There's an up and down. You probably went through, let's say, every sleep cycle is somewhere between an hour and a half and 2 hours. Some people it's as short as 1 hour, but generally an hour and a half to two. So let's just say you went through five sleep cycles. You came into that light stage of sleep multiple times. That's the time when you're most likely to be aroused. Some people think that they wake up because they have to go to the bathroom, but it's really a lot of times it's because they're going transitioning from the deep sleep into the light sleep, and they notice that they have to go to the bathroom. Or that's the time when if there's a loud noise or a bright light is turned on, that you're going to be roused from sleep. Whereas if you're in the deepest sleep, it may not rouse you at all. So that's the in and out stage. Stage two is light sleep. And it's the beginning of your true sleep where your muscles become relaxed and you have that loss of awareness. And that's actually 50% of your sleep. And then the other 25% is in your deep sleep. And there's deep sleep and deepest sleep. Stage four is actually the restorative sleep. And then stage five is the REM sleep where you'd be breathing. The REM sleep should be 25%. The deep and the deepest should be 25%, the light 50%, and the stage one is just your in and out. So that's a normal sleep cycle. That's a normal thing. You know, everybody has a little bit of variation, but it's important to know this. Why? Because if somebody's having difficulty with sleeping, one of the things you want to do is optimize their sleep cycles. And I give you a whole process in a paper that you can read about and you can apply with people. And I think I have a slide that summarizes it. Yes. That you can analyze the sleep cycle and help people decide what time to go to bed. So, for example, if you know that your sleep cycle, including the transition sleep, is about, let's say, an hour and a half, and you need to get up at 7 a.m., that's your drop-dead time, you have to get up at that time to go to work, and you're trying to decide what time to go to bed, if you were to take, let's say, go back 6 hours from that, that would be four sleep cycles, right? Seven minus six, that's one. If you wanted to get five sleep cycles, that's 7.5 hours, that would be, say, 11:30. But if you find that since you have to get up at seven, you don't want to get up in the middle of a sleep cycle. You want to make sure that you get up at the end of a sleep cycle because that's going to be really restful. If you don't get up at the end, if you get woken up in the middle, you might as well have wasted that sleep cycle. So an easy thing to do is to go backwards in time and say, okay, so it's right now, it's midnight. Midnight. I should have gone to bed at 11:30 to get 7.5 hours sleep. I'm only going to get four sleep cycles now, and then you plan to go to bed right before, so you fall asleep right about one, like, you know, 15 minutes before to give yourself the transition time. And that way you don't get in bed and then end up feeling groggy. If you wake up from a full sleep cycle, you feel good. If you wake up in the middle of a sleep cycle, you feel groggy. So this is some things that you can share with people. It's a little bit more sophisticated and more advanced, but I just wanted to make you aware of it, and there's a lot more detail on the site. So let's talk about the hormones that need to be balanced while you sleep. Insulin and glucagon. We've talked at length about those. Insulin helps to reduce your blood sugar. Glucagon helps to raise it. So if your blood sugar starts to fall in the middle of the night, glucagon should be released by the pancreas, goes out to the liver, finds some stored glycogen, releases just enough of it to keep your blood sugar where it needs to be, right up there at the, you know, the 75 to 85 range. You shouldn't be secreting insulin while you sleep at all. Okay? If everything's regulated right, you should not be secreting it. However, some people eat right before they go to bed, so they're secreting insulin. The insulin interferes with growth hormone. When insulin goes high, growth hormone goes down. So if you eat right before bed, within a three-hour period before bed, and there's insulin in your system, that surge of growth hormone that happens within the first hour of sleep doesn't happen. That interferes with your growth and repair. Cortisol and DHEA, well, again, cortisol should be at a minimum while you're sleeping. The lowest level of cortisol happens right around midnight. If you eat right before you go to bed, you have a temporary rise in cortisol, and that can affect the sleep and the amount of DHEA, because again, they're antagonistic. Not that they can't coexist, like insulin and growth hormone are really at odds, but because cortisol steals away some of the precursors for DHEA, we tend to have lower DHEA when we have higher cortisol. Growth hormone is really major hormone, and you need to have these spikes. The first spike within an hour of going to sleep is pretty high, and then the next one is a little bit lower, a little bit lower, a little bit lower. You generally have one growth hormone spike per sleep cycle, and it happens right at the beginning in that second stage, that stage two sleep. Leptin and ghrelin. Leptin is secreted by the fat cells to say, hey, I'm fat, I'm full. No need to eat any more food. Shut off the appetite. We got plenty of fat here. Come burn it. Ghrelin is the opposite. Says, hey, feed me. It's secreted by the cells that line the stomach. And when ghrelin gets secreted, it says, hey, we need food. Hey. And ghrelin actually temporarily raises growth hormone. Okay, because it's growth hormone will go burn some fat, right? So when you have ghrelin in the system, you raise your growth hormone. Not a good idea to keep ghrelin like at a peak level for too long, because it does have some negative side effects, and it can cause you to be like ravenously hungry. But if you can have people tolerate a little bit of hunger, like I say, learn to make friends with hunger. If you can live with a half an hour of hunger, you can be really happy knowing that ghrelin is stimulating the release of growth hormone, and growth hormone is stimulating growth and repair, lean muscle storage, and fat burning. So it's a happy situation. Melatonin, we all know, is very, very important during sleep. And insulin will affect the release of melatonin. So if you eat something right before bed, then the melatonin isn't going to spike when it needs to get you into that deep state of sleep. So it's a really critical piece is no food before bed. You do not want an insulin spike before bed, because not only does it interfere with growth hormone and stimulate a little bit of cortisol, but it also affects the melatonin. And then estrogen, progesterone have effects as well as testosterone. Progesterone helps you to fall asleep better. Excess estrogen stimulates insulin insensitivity. And we've got a slide on each of these to go into a little bit more detail. So there's a lot of small print on this slide, and I wanted to include studies if you wanted to look to see where this information was coming from. But overall, like I said, sleep debt causes impairment of the endocrine system. It can affect your cardiovascular system. It can affect your immune system. Here's the deal. If you go 4 days with restricted of sleep for 4 hours, the glucose clearance rate is depressed by 40%. 40%. It's like you have gestational diabetes. So no wonder I ate pineapple and my blood sugar shot up to 167. My glucose clearance rate was depressed by 40%, probably more, because I had more than 4 days of sleep restriction to 4 hours a day. Really important. You know, I didn't realize I was doing myself so much harm with the lack of sleep. And a lot of people aren't. They just feel okay. You know, they're going on adrenaline and they feel okay. So glucose tolerance is decreased during sleep debt. That's another study. Same thing. Doesn't quantify it the same, but same. There's a couple of studies there. 3 days of 10 to 12 hours of sleep, this is the good news, can normalize fasting glucose. 3 days. That's not bad. That's why I tell people to do a 3-day sleep vacation. Just take some time. Go to bed. You can do this like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You can come home from work on Friday night and go to bed. Don't eat. Go to bed. Make sure you wait 3 hours. Go to bed and just stay in bed 12 hours. Even if you don't sleep the full 12 hours, stay in bed for those 12 hours. And then do some light stuff the rest of the day. Don't make a bunch of appointments and running around. And then the next night, same thing. Go to bed early. Stay in bed for 12 hours. Do that 3 nights in a row, and you can normalize fasting glucose. Try it. If you have someone that you're working with higher fasting glucose, and you're working on the other things as well, but it's not really putting a dent in it, try this. Try it yourself. Sleep deprivation disrupts the normal pattern of growth hormone surge during the first 3 hours of sleep. So that's the big one, within an hour usually. And that's another study. So there's a lot of evidence that supports this. So what's the big deal about growth hormone? Well, we don't necessarily aspire to a body like that. Not bad. But we want the other effects of growth hormone as well. We want the lean tissue. We want the repair, right? The growth, the rejuvenation of your organs. So growth hormone will cause an increase in protein synthesis in every cell. So if you've exercised, lifted weights during the day, but you don't allow the growth hormone surges at night, you're not going to be building new muscle. But if you do, the increased protein synthesis by growth hormone is going to help you to build new muscle. It helps to promote the release of fat from the cells. Now, you might be one of these people who's underweight. There are a few of you out there. But most people are like, yeah, bring it on. I want to burn fat. And even some of you who are underweight may not be under fat. You may be under lean. So growth hormone is your friend there too. It helps to shift your cells from burning glycogen and glucose to burning fat. So that's a good thing. And it promotes insulin sensitivity. But it will not be in the system when insulin's there. It's like, oh, insulin, I don't like that cousin. I'm running away. It goes away. Levels go down. So once the insulin levels get back down to baseline, growth hormone can come out and do its thing, which is really why I keep emphasizing no food late at night. Okay? And also, another trick, we talked about this in the exercise pieces, don't eat too close to working out. Because while you're working out, especially if you're doing burst training, you get this big spike of growth hormone. But then if you eat right after that, something that secretes insulin, the growth hormone level goes down and it doesn't sustain itself for the hour and a half that it normally would. So really, timing is really important. We'll talk more about those timing things on our next session. So growth hormone is secreted in response to an emptying stomach. So when ghrelin gets secreted, it's secreted in response to increased amino acids in the bloodstream. It's increased in response to exercise and the intensity of exercise. The more intense the exercise, the higher the growth hormone peak. They found that 30 seconds of high-intensity burst training increases growth hormone as much as 30 minutes of low-intensity aerobics. And finally, deep sleep, and we have those spikes a few times a night. So cortisol and growth hormone, how does that affect? Well, cortisol affects the rate of fat burning in terms of it reduces the rate of fat burning by inhibiting lipolysis and increasing gluconeogenesis. So cortisol will help the protein to break down and the fat to be stored. That's the opposite of what you want, isn't it? Growth hormone, when you add the growth hormone into that, it increases the rate of fat burning. But the cortisol surge before bed inhibits the growth hormone surge. So if you happen to eat right before bed, that's going to cause a little bit of a growth hormone surge. Some people have high levels of cortisol at night. Some people have been abused in the night. And those are things you need to be asking. And they're on guard all night long. So their cortisol levels go up. And if you do an adrenal stress index, you can see what happens to that when somebody's cortisol levels go up high. You know that that person's going to have a hard time with lean muscle storage and fat burning. Because of that cortisol surge at bedtime. It inhibits the growth hormone surge. So let's change gears and talk about another hormone called leptin. Leptin is a new kid on the block. Leptin was first discovered in the 1990s. So it's like one of the newest hormones. And it was an amazing discovery. It's secreted by the white adipose tissue. That stuff around your waist that the insulin levels go up and they cause fat storage there, that's where the white adipose, it's in other places in your body as well, but that's what produces leptin. It says, I'm full, got enough. And it signals both the hypothalamus and the pancreas that we're full. Okay, there's receptors in the hypothalamus and the pancreas. So the response for the hypothalamus, which is the control system in your brain, is like, let's turn off the appetite. So the pancreas's response is, let's stop producing insulin. We're good to go. So there's a 24-hour circadian rhythm, but it's also controlled by eating patterns. What happens is if someone gets overweight, they override this, right? People eat to be so stuffed, like you just keep eating this food because it's so addictive, and they override it. They add a lot of this leptin being produced because they've got a lot of fat cells. The hypothalamus and the pancreas both eventually get resistant. Just like you get insulin resistant, you get leptin resistant. You can also get thyroid resistant, where your cells get resistant to its own thyroid. You can get progesterone resistant. And most recently, I've found studies linking resistance to estrogen as well. So we can become resistant to all the hormones when there's a flood and an excess that burns out the receptors. So this is your normal leptin function. You start in the evening is when it starts to go up. It's pretty low level throughout the day. This is the circadian rhythm. It also goes up in response to food or down in response to food. Leptin is, if leptin is there and you're not leptin resistant, as it goes up after dinner, you lose your appetite. You're not supposed to be hungry at bedtime. If you have somebody who says, I just get so hungry at bedtime, it's probably because their leptin surged too early and is now coming down, right? And that can happen by eating carbohydrates too early in the day. It causes an early peak in the carbohydrate, in the leptin levels. So the leptin levels peak approximately 2 hours after you fall asleep. And then they start to go down. And as they start to go down, then fat burning gets at its peak. So when leptin levels are fat burning is high when it peaks. So it gradually goes down, and you're going, okay? So the fat burning time begins right when the leptin peaks. It increases up to a certain point, and when leptin gets to a certain level, then the fat burning is going to go back down as well, which is normally in the morning. So right at 8 a.m., leptin's back down to its lowest level. Okay. When you have a cycle that looks like this, you promote weight loss and normal metabolism. If the leptin peaks too early and it's down too soon, you're going to be starving throughout the day because the leptin levels are not where they should be. And if you're insulin leptin resistant, you're going to find that you're starving throughout the day. There's a really good book I really like called Mastering Leptin. And it goes through lots of detail, big, thick book, 400 pages, lots of references. So I'm trying to just simplify this down from 400 pages worth of information. With leptin resistance, you see, the peak is earlier. See, the peak is somewhere between 6 p.m. and dinner. You're still awake. The leptin levels are going down, and you're getting hungry. Well, I want food cravings. I want carbs. And then when this happens, the fat burning doesn't start until later, and you don't get as long a period of fat burning. Therefore, you don't get as much fat burning. So we want to prevent leptin resistance. And there's some rules for managing leptin and your insulin that will keep this in line. Never eat after dinner. Really. Like, you finish your dinner, you're done. You leave 3 hours between dinner and bedtime. Byron Richards in his Mastering Leptin says 12 hours is the ideal spacing between dinner and breakfast the next day. So you need a 12-hour fast. Only eat 3 meals a day, because when you eat in between meals, it triggers an alteration of the leptin pattern. 5 to 6 hours between meals. Now, you're going to be working with people who might be eating every 2 hours because that's what they've been told. You have insulin problems. You have reactive hypoglycemia. Therefore, you need to eat every 2 hours. Wrong. Not good. 5 to 6 hours between meals. And there's a ton of research behind this. Get the Mastering Leptin book and you'll see it. I've also given you some on the site. Don't eat too much, because eating too much, that just turns the mechanism off. Eating slowly, so your body gets the signal that I've had enough. A breakfast containing protein. The worst thing in the world is the standard kind of breakfast that people do, which is toast and orange juice. and coffee, or cereal and orange juice and coffee, okay, or a fruit smoothie and toast, or a bagel. Bad, bad news, okay? Too much carbohydrate. So some people go the opposite extreme in their insulin resistance books. They'll say, bacon and eggs for breakfast. Well, that's not exactly a balanced breakfast either. That's just protein and fat and not the highest quality. So I like to see people doing what I recommend here is something with omega-3 fats like a chia or a flax pudding or porridge or cracker or bread and something green because green gives you lots of protein. And you can also add protein powders and other things like that to it, but green in the morning is great. If people are not into drinking green smoothies or green drinks in the morning, fine. Help them to learn how to make stir fries or steamed vegetables or eat a salad for breakfast. I know that's a little weird for a lot of people, but it really helps. And green powders are a great transition for lots of people. It's just real easy. Reduce the intake of starchy carbohydrates, not just in the morning, but overall. But if they're going to continue to eat, they want rice, they want bread, and they're not willing to give it up, at least change when they eat it, and it'll make a huge difference. Have them do it later in the day with dinner instead of breakfast. So here's some meal timing rules. No snacking because the more frequent insulin spikes decrease the leptin, promote obesity. Maintaining ideal body weight. Obesity increases insulin resistance, and insulin resistance increases obesity. So you've got to break that vicious cycle. I've said this ad infinitum, no eating at night causes insulin, increases growth hormone and leptin, decrease causes you to not burn as much fat during the night, not go into growth and repair state, and then have cravings the next day. Avoiding the high carbohydrate breakfast, we saw what happened to the insulin curve. It spikes sooner, and then you get cravings for food between dinner and bedtime. So if you're going to do the carbs, it's got to be later in the day. Of course, you know, we have our whole list of foods that we're trying to get them to avoid. Eating a protein within an hour of wakening promotes growth hormone and regulates insulin. So it even can be just a green drink or a protein powder. It doesn't have to be bacon and eggs, okay? So I included ghrelin just for completeness. It's not really affected by sleep, but it's that ghrelin-leptin balance and its effect on growth hormones. I just wanted to give you a little bit of information about it. Secreted by the cells in the stomach wall, and eating suppresses ghrelin. So you get the ghrelin, you get hungry, you eat, and the ghrelin goes away. An empty stomach will secrete lots of ghrelin, and ghrelin stimulates appetite, of course, and it stimulates growth hormone. So it's not a bad idea to wait until you're really hungry. If you wait and you eat every time you get that little bit of hunger, then you lose the opportunity to have a growth hormone surge. And it'll help you with fat burning and muscle sparing if you do. I like to just call it making friends with hunger. You know, hunger is just another sensation. If you have an itch in a place that's not socially acceptable to scratch in public, you generally forego the scratching until you're in private. Same thing with eating. You don't have to eat every single time there's hunger. Learning to live with hunger, it's just another sensation. If you've ever had teeth drilled on or had a toothache, that's worse than hunger. You can deal with hunger. If you've ever given birth to a baby, that's a lot worse than hunger pangs. So we don't have to satisfy hunger every time we have hunger, the same way we don't have to satisfy itches every time we do, the same thing we don't have to have a bowel movement every time we get the urge. So melatonin, critical for sleep, produced by your pineal gland, not your pituitary, your pineal gland. And it's affected by light, so light going through your eyes affects the release of melatonin. So when we talk about ways to manage and get better sleep, you're going to see some more interesting ways to manage melatonin related to exposure to light. It's turned on by low light. It's turned off by bright light. So in the evening, we have this artificial bright light because we live in homes rather than in caves and in the woods like animals do. So there's some really good things I'll have on my list of things that you can share with people to help, which has to do with turning the lights down. Melatonin is very highly protective of tumor growth, especially estrogen-related tumors, breast cancer in particular. When you sit at the computer and TV at night, which we're all doing right now, by the way, we are reducing our melatonin. So not a great idea to have these things at night, but it's really the only time because most of us are busy with other things during the day. So when you, if you really want to optimize somebody's melatonin, help them to stop watching TV or computer at least an hour or two before bedtime. Eating too close to bedtime inhibits it, just like it inhibits the growth hormone. And it's produced from tryptophan and requires vitamin B6. So deficiencies of these, inability to digest protein well because of low stomach acid. So it's important to be looking at the person's digestion as well in order to have the balance of these hormones. So progesterone, how does progesterone have to do with sleep? And what does it have to do with insulin resistance? Well, more than you think. It promotes deep sleep, so some people will get really good effect. If they're having trouble sleeping because of a progesterone deficiency, they can take progesterone at bedtime and fall asleep really well. It helps prevent lipid peroxidation. Right? That's the breakdown, the oxidation of cells and cell membranes, and that can affect insulin receptors. It's anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, so it reduces things called NK cells, natural killer cells, TNF-alpha and TH1, which are cytokines that have to do with inflammation. And it helps to stimulate the production of interleukin 4 and 10 and increase glutathione and superoxide dismutase. So it's really important to have good levels of progesterone. And where I'm going to tie this in is when you're under a lot of stress, you're using the precursors to progesterone to make cortisol. And so your protection against these things goes down. Your inflammation goes up. The insulin receptors get damaged. It also suppresses excess estrogen. And estrogen dominance can lead to all sorts of imbalances, which we'll talk about in a moment. It activates GABA receptor sites. And GABA is a neurotransmitter that calms you down. So if people don't have enough progesterone, they may not be making enough GABA, or they may not be activating the receptor sites for GABA, and that interferes with the sleep. And finally, it's involved with the regulation of hypoglycemia. It gets into play along with glucagon or adrenaline, depending on the seriousness of the hypoglycemia. Usually when you go into a hypoglycemic state, that's an emergency situation that's sent out, and the body produces adrenaline and cortisol to bring it back up. We know that that's not good. So there's a lot of ways that all of our hormones are coming into play during sleep and then affecting the receptors for insulin. Estrogen can have an effect on promoting deeper sleep beyond hot flash control. There were a number of studies that said, you know, we thought that estrogen helped with sleep because it helped control hot flashes, but there's more than that. Excess estrogen in males can induce insulin resistance. There are a number of studies about that. Oral contraceptives that include estrogen, which they all do, increase insulin resistance. So we know that estrogen, higher levels of estrogen, increase insulin resistance. So when we have deficiency in progesterone, it allows the estrogen to get out of balance, and the combination of the two contributes to more profound insulin resistance. And how do we get estrogen dominant? Plastics in the environment, a lot of xenoestrogens, dental materials, birth control pills. There's all sorts of ways to get estrogen dominant, and a lot of people are estrogen dominant. Estrogen increases the amount of time people had REM sleep and reduced time awake. So it's not just that estrogen is bad, progesterone is good. You need the right amount. So too little estrogen can reduce the amount of REM sleep that you've got, and you end up being awake more. So you need the kind of Goldilocks principle, right? Just the right amount. We know how important the management of stress is to managing all the rest of the steroid hormones, the DHEA, the estrogen, the progesterone, and the testosterone. So going back to all the techniques you've got in your module that help with stress. Now, on the one hand, we go, wow, this whole insulin resistance thing, it's simple. You just put them on a low glycemic diet. You see that it's a lot more than that. For some, just doing the diet is great. And even doing the diet is not just like, oh, it's so easy. It's hard for some people. But these other factors play huge roles. And I have a lot of people who will go on the Before Be Gone program, and they're doing the diet, and they're saying to me, I don't understand. I've been doing this diet for 6 weeks, and my hormone levels, my glucose levels are still high. I still have a high fasting glucose. Why do you think that is? And I'm like, whoa. Can you hear the tone in your voice? You're really stressed about it, and you don't realize how much that affects them. Okay? It's really, really important to control these things. And the stress is, like we said, not just the emotional and mental. So if they've got a hidden infection somewhere in their gut or in their joints, they're going to have a stress on their system, inflammation somewhere, arthritic joints, an autoimmune process. All those things are going to contribute to the stress, the physiological stress. So it's really about balance in the whole body. We're focusing on insulin resistance because it's super important. And there are a lot of ways to get it under control. But you can't overlook the stresses happening in the rest of the body. It's really you being the detective that determines what's really going on for this person. And finally, we've got testosterone. And it's associated with snoring and sleep apnea. Somebody doesn't have enough. And excess testosterone in women is associated with insulin resistance. So we went back to excess estrogen in men and excess testosterone in women. So it's a matter of having the right amounts of our particular sex hormones and the right amounts of the opposite sex hormones. Right? Sleep can increase testosterone. So if somebody's testosterone deficient, getting a good night's sleep is important. Sleep deprivation decreases testosterone. That makes sense, right? When they look at diabetics, across the board, they have a lower level of testosterone. So testosterone contributes to, lack of testosterone contributes to insulin resistance. And we know that men who have low levels of testosterone have more belly fat. That happens a lot to men as they get older. Women go through menopause, men go through andropause. And in andropause, you end up with men who get, you know, low energy and belly fat. Well, it may have something to do with the insulin resistance being induced by low levels of testosterone. We're almost at the end, guys. We're going to talk about your resources. So you've got the background into why sleep is so important. You're going to have to watch this a few times and read through all the resources, and it'll take time before you own this. But the more people you work on with this, the more you're going to own this. So within there, I've given you resources, a document about herbs and supplements to assist with sleep. There's a document about understanding sleep cycles. There's a document about hormones that dance in your sleep. And then there's a resource list of the hormones involved with sleep and how they affect blood sugar. And then there's a document that's just a bunch of studies, lists to studies. It's really important that you have some good sleep resources under your belt. Not just for your insulin-resistant patients, but in general, you're going to see insomnia coming through a lot, and there's a lot you can do with lifestyle and nutrition. We're all about fixing things as much as you can with lifestyle and nutrition. I've given you lots of resources. And not everything's going to work with every person, but you'll have a lot of tools in your toolkit. It's nice when you don't have just one tool in your toolkit. It's often said about modern medicine is when you have only one, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if the only tool you have is some pharmaceutical medication to deal with insulin resistance, then that's what everybody's going to get, and they're overlooking really making a profound difference. That's what's going to set you apart. We've talked about many of these things. I've just pulled them all together, and they're talked about in greater detail on the site and the documents you have. Stop eating within 3 hours of bedtime. I think I've made a case for that by now. If you dim the lights in the evening, you'll stimulate the natural environment, and that will stimulate melatonin. So it doesn't mean you have to turn off the lights, but turn down to low incandescent lights. You know, read by candlelight. Do things that are softer. rather than sitting in the bright lights and sitting in front of a TV or a computer. Within 2 hours would be nice. The TV, if you're going to do the TV in bed, make sure they've got the lights closed and they're reclining to watch it. But it's not a good idea. It's just hard to break people of that habit. Avoid intense exercise close to bedtime. I know people who go out for a run and then they take a shower and go to bed. Not great for sleep. And it's going to, you know, keep the body temperature higher, and it's not going to allow you to get into the optimal hormone balance during sleep. For some people, hot baths interfere with sleep, but if they take a nice lukewarm or neutral bath, it can be really helpful for helping the body to go down. That you'll have to just see what works for different people. And, of course, meditations, visualizations, the mini vacations, the little heart map excursions right before bed is going to turn down the cortisol. So I recommend people get into bed. If they've got anything on their mind, to take out a piece of paper, a notebook next to it, and just jot it all down. Get it out of your mind so it doesn't keep you awake during sleep. And once you've done that, then go ahead and lie down, close the lights, and do some appreciations. Find three things that you appreciate more than anything throughout the day. And then do a little mini vacation. Go to the beach. Make it longer. In your stress transformation bonus, I teach you all about the other techniques within HeartMath, and there's one they call Heart Lock-In. Nice time to do it would be before going to bed. Have your people learn how to do that. You can teach them once you learn yourself. Next part, avoid intense mental activity within 2 hours of bedtime. So if you're taking a physics course and you're having a test the next day, studying right up to bedtime is going to keep those cortisol levels peaked. It's going to affect the hormone balance. If you have outdoor activity early in the day before 1 p.m., that gets the bright light in through your eyes and decreases the melatonin during the day, so it's allowed to increase later. If you stay indoors all day in the dark and then you go out later, that's going to really throw off your melatonin levels. And the best thing to do, if you can, is first thing in the morning when you get up within the first 15 minutes is to go out and just let the sunlight bathe into your eyes. Even if it's not bright and sunny yet, that's going to help to turn the melatonin off so that it's down for the day and then comes up later in the night as soon as you turn the lights down. Bright lights off as soon as possible after sunset. Go camping sometimes. You know, go camping and you may have that little incandescent flashlight that you read by, but that's not going to really affect you too much. It's the bright lights. The neutral bath, we talked about that. Before bed, 15 to 60 minutes, somewhere in that time range, especially if you throw in lavender oil. This is for somebody who's having trouble falling asleep. And I'll give you a list of herbs, best to take them between 30 and 60 minutes before bed, and then again at bedtime for somebody who has a lot of really serious problems falling asleep. And the choice of herbs is going to depend. You're going to have to play it by ear, learn about the herbs, and choose the right one. And then it's really a good idea to be horizontal for 30 minutes to an hour before sleep. So if you lay down and just allow your body to rest into it and maybe read a little bit or just meditate or do a heart math excursion, that would be really great. These are all things that help optimize sleep. Here are some herbs and supplements. I've just given you like a little one-liner about these. I recommend that you just go explore them and read about them and see which ones that you're going to use if you have a problem yourself or your clients have problems. There's also a bunch of Chinese herbs, which my Chinese herb Materia Medica is not my strong suite. But passion flower is really great for people who've got the mind chatter. They're thinking about this and that and can't turn off the brain. Passion flower can do a great job with that. Lemon balm relaxes the mind but also the whole body. Chamomile is real soothing, relaxes muscles, it relaxes the digestion. Hops is a little bit stronger than the ones above, but really good relaxing. I'll tell you, right before I did my elbow surgery, I wasn't doing anesthesia, but I wanted to be relaxed. I took a whole bunch of hops in the morning and valerian before I went there, and then I took another heavy dose of valerian, and I think the combination had hops and lemon balm and a bunch of other stuff in it. I took that right before I went so it would calm me down, and it made a huge difference. I could feel my body. I was kind of dozy. Only lasted for 45 minutes because it was a bit of a different situation than sleep. Phosphatidylserine is an amino acid that helps to decrease cortisol levels. the production of cortisol. So if you have somebody who's just really that high at night, or they have a history of abuse or being broken into their house and robbed during the night, somewhere where they don't feel safe at night, phosphatidylserine would be good. And if you've done an adrenal stress index and they have high cortisol. Magnolia is another one, really good at helping to calm down the cortisol, stress-induced sleeplessness. And then adrenal adaptogens and learning about those, that would be really helpful as well. So extras, we've talked about all of these already. I don't know why they're listed as extras, but getting out in the morning sun, critical, using relaxing herbs before bed, schedule a 3-day sleep vacation. Remember we talked 10 to 12 hours of sleep 3 days in a row can help reset the insulin receptors. And sleep in as dark an environment as possible. And this is critical because some people sleep with their bedrooms or in the front of the house. They don't even realize that that's affecting their sleep, the bright light coming in. So room darkening shades or some eye covers, there's a number of ways that they could do that so that it's really dark. Turning off or alarm clocks turned away, or having the dimmer turned way down, those bright red lights, the LEDs are not good for promoting deep sleep. So that's what we have for your stress and your emotional and your sleep issues related to insulin resistance. I know there's a lot here. I wanted to give you as much as possible. There's more. There's background. You can read the stuff that we'll have on the site and really learn this stuff and really be able to work with people. The more you work with people, the more natural it's going to become. The more you listen to me talk about it, the more natural it's going to become. The more you read about it, the more easily you're going to be able to access the information. Okay? It's not rocket science. But it's nice to understand the mechanisms so that you can then put it into place. You may not remember exactly all the mechanisms and be able to recite everything that I've taught you tonight, but you're going to have the sense, wow, that, you know, it's really important to manage the stress. What are some of the tools that work best? Really important to deal with the sleep and the hormone balance and the timing, all the things that you can control. So I'm open for questions. If you have any, I'll go and check on the Q&A. I'll check on the website to see if there's any in the Ask the Doctor section, and raise your hand *2 if you have a question. If you have a comment, I'd love to hear how you're doing with your own insulin resistance checking. How are you doing with the dietary things, the exercise things, measuring your own glucose? Where are you at with it? I'd love to hear from you. So *2 to share, and type your question and answers in. I'm going to do a refresh. And by the way, the copies of all the slides were already loaded up to the Instant Teleseminar page in the 4 per page as well as the single page, so whichever way you prefer. And there are some questions that have been put in. I'll go ahead and answer them, and then I'll go back and check to see if anybody has their hands up. Tracy. Hi, Tracy. I recently spoke to a man who has MS and mentioned that his doctor said that working with a nutritionist would help lower the inflammation in his body. Hey, yay! I noticed that he has a lot of weight around his stomach and immediately wondered about his blood sugar. I know what I will learn about him after he fills out the health assessment, but have you worked with clients who have had MS? Yeah, very early on in my practice, I worked with somebody with MS, and we had tremendous results with doing allergy elimination, so getting him off gluten and those sorts of things, fatty acid balance, and of course blood sugar balance is critical. Okay, so yeah, there's a lot that you can do, and just get the health assessment and just go for it. Whatever is showing up, you work on. You ask some more stuff about the diet and his habits, and you'll be able to assess very quickly about the insulin resistance, and you can work with him there. That'd be great. So there's some charts on the website that says Before Be Gone has a webinar on September 25th is not happening. We've moved the Before Be Gone stuff up by 1 week, so that's not going to be until September. I think it's October 3rd or something. But the updates should be there. If you go to the schedule page, that should be there. So that webinar is, no, it's we're moving it out. We just got too far behind. This surgery really put me back quite a bit, and we didn't get a chance to get everything done that we wanted to. But we will be releasing a set of videos starting, it's probably tomorrow. I have to check back with my team and see if everything's ready to do that. I've got some videos, and we have some extra bonuses that we're going to be doing. You guys will get in. Of course, it's part of your program, so you'll get all the information you need to sign up. We're going to create a little link. You'll just have to go and click that link in the email, and that will automatically open it up once it's ready to open up. We're still making some changes in there. We are always updating and improving every time we do a program, so we want to make sure that you get the latest. We don't want you in there and poking around and finding things that end up changing. That would be too confusing. So Eleanor says, I'm getting confused between the role of leptin and glucagon. Leptin is released by the fat cell and tells the pancreas to stop secreting insulin. Blood sugar drops over time and the pancreas releases glucagon to burn fat. Right, no. Okay. The blood sugar, glucagon generally doesn't burn fat. It usually goes to the liver and gets some stored glycogen. The difference is glucagon is stimulated when the blood sugar goes down. So if you're maintaining your blood sugar at, say, it's 85, you eat a meal, and say it's a meal that has a lot of sugar in it and you're insulin resistant and your blood sugar goes up to 150, you are going to be producing insulin. Your leptin is going to be produced but not heard because of the high level of insulin and because the pancreas is probably insulin leptin resistant. But when you finally get all the sugar stored into your cells and the blood sugar goes down, the leptin gets the signal. The leptin signal is heard then, and it tells the pancreas to stop producing insulin. But that doesn't happen in insulin resistance. That's in the normal situation, right? So blood sugar, okay, so the difference is leptin is not there to regulate blood sugar. Its job is to tell the body, turn off the appetite. The side effect of that is that it triggers the release of fat. Glucagon is there for when the blood sugar starts to drop. Leptin is not affected by blood sugar dropping. Leptin is affected by the amount of fat in a fat cell. That's the difference. Yeah, so the question is, does leptin rise and trigger fat burning? Does leptin trigger fat burning or does glucagon? Glucagon generally doesn't trigger fat burning unless there's no glycogen in the liver. Glucagon goes to the liver, takes some of the stored glycogen, releases it very gently to maintain the blood sugar. As soon as the blood sugar is back to the normal level, glucagon turns off, different from leptin. On the reversing insulin resistance slide, what does reduced stress via hypercortisolemia mean? It means that when you get stressed, you have extra cortisol, and the reducing stress is to reduce the cortisol. So I'm not sure which slide that is, so if you could tell me a slide number, I'll go back to it, but basically, the gist is we want to reduce insulin resistance by reducing hypercortisolemia, or we want to help to reduce that. Does that make sense? So when you reduce your stress, you reduce the hypercortisolemia. Hypercortisolemia meaning excess cortisol in the blood. Tracy wants to know, how do you feel about listening to tapes while going to bed? I listen to help tapes while going to sleep. That's great, because it's not like you're not listening to something that is requiring you to sit there and take notes and be extremely aware and awake. You're listening to something relaxing that's good for your body to learn, and you can do it with the lights out, with your eyes closed. I think it's a good thing. Michaeline. Chronically raised cortisol levels can contribute to imbalanced and resistant hypothalamus. Let's see. I'm not sure if cortisol has a direct effect on the hypothalamus. That I'm not sure about. It can affect, high levels of cortisol can affect the resistance to leptin, the leptin resistance in the hypothalamus, as well as high levels of cortisol can affect resistance of your cells to thyroid. So high levels of cortisol will cause various cells in your body to become resistant. Yes. Michaeline also says magnesium calm in the evening to help sleep. Yes, that can help some people if they happen to be deficient in magnesium. It's always a matter of finding the right thing for the right person. Some people have a phenomenal response to taking magnesium before bed, to putting Epsom salts in the bath or magnesium oil either in the bath or on the skin, really calming. For others, it doesn't have so much of an effect. Lisa, I go to bed at 10 p.m., but after 1 to 2, I start waking up every hour or so. What can cause that and how can I fix it? This is causing the morning glucose to be high. Well, it sounds like there's some sort of stress going on in your system at that point. And it could be you need to do an adrenal stress index and see if it's related to cortisol levels going high. If you are going to bed at 10, I'm assuming that you're having your last meal by 7 and then it's a low glycemic meal, because if you're eating between the 7 and 10 and you're eating anything that's going to cause your insulin to go up, that can be causing a hyperinsulin spike and then cause the insulin to get your blood sugar too low. When the blood sugar gets too low during the night, it could be stimulating cortisol to wake you up. I'd also look at, have you had any traumas or anything that happened to you during the night that caused you to be up on a regular basis? It sometimes happens to women after they've given birth and then they've had babies who wake them up in the middle of the night. You get so used to that, their body just gets there and it has to reset. So there's a number of things. And going through, if you're doing every single thing on this sleep procedure and it's still happening, then I would say go do an adrenal stress index and see what's happening. And you may need to be doing some of the phosphatidylserine or magnolia or some other calming herbs at bedtime. Beverly says, is a nice lower glucose after eating always a sign of reactive hypoglycemia? I don't mean really low, but I mean like 83. Generally not, and I would follow it out to make sure, Beverly. Generally, reactive hypoglycemia involves going down below your baseline by about 10 points or more, and the more serious it is. So if you've got a fasting, if you've got a glucose of, say, in the 80s, and then you eat and it's still in the 80s, I don't think that's hypoglycemia. But if your blood sugar is in, say, the 90s, and you eat a food that's relatively high glycemic, that's going to trigger some insulin response, most likely it going down is in response to that. However, if you eat something that has some natural lowering agents in it, like chia seeds or carob or some of the other foods we talked about last week that help to lower the insulin, increase the insulin resistance, then it could just be because it's helping to get the glucose into the cells. So I would monitor it out for a good 5 or 6 hours, as we describe in part one. Christine, should a person first do the blood glucose readings on the foods they have been regularly eating? If so, for how many days? Should they do a week's worth of reading, 7 days? When should the client start to change the diet? As soon as they are ready mentally and emotionally. Okay, so yeah. So I would say that it's a great idea to do it on the foods they've been regularly eating. That's why I introduced the blood sugar testing right at the beginning, before I even introduced the main dietary changes. How long? Well, I really think if you just do it for several days to a week is great, especially if they eat a varied diet. But if they eat the same things every single day, then doing it for a day or two just to see, probably 2 days just to kind of compare, that gives you an idea. But a 7-day period would give you a wide variety of all the foods that they generally eat, and so that's a good idea if you can get them to do that. If you can't, then you're going to pick and choose, and you're going to ask them for a diet diary, what do they normally eat, and just pick out the times that you see the most potentially problematic foods and get them to check those. And when they should change the diet. Well, once they've got the baseline readings, any time after that, as long as they're ready, and if you've put them on the glucose lowering, the insulin resistance improving supplements, then once they're on those for 7 to 10 days, they may have a little bit of an easier time because they're not going to have as intense cravings. And then if you get them, if they're really resistant about the diet, but you can get them to do the simple timing things we talked about at first, which is the not eating before bed and spacing their meals a little bit more, you might start to see that it makes it easier to make the dietary changes. Terry, I'm still confused as to what causes the blood sugar to drop too low, such as hypoglycemia. I understand the insulin resistance cycle, but don't get where the low blood sugar fits the cycle. Okay, and what is a low blood glucose level? So that's a good question. If somebody is in the stage where they're producing too much insulin and they're not yet insulin resistant, then their blood sugar can go up as a result of a high glycemic meal. Their body produces too much insulin and it brings it down too low below the baseline. That's one way. Another way is if they are insulin resistant and they're producing too much insulin, then their blood sugar goes up and they produce a lot of insulin and the sugar is staying up, so the pancreas produces more insulin. It just keeps producing more insulin, and finally it reaches a threshold where the insulin triggers the storage of all that sugar as fat, and it does it really rapidly because there's so much there, and boom, the blood sugar drops below base. What's a low glycemic level, blood sugar level? It's a good question. I'd say it really relates to where they started from, but once you get into this 60s and 50s, it's a problem. And it has to do with, again, how much did it drop. So if it started in the 80s and they ate a meal and 2 hours later it's in the 70s or 60s, and especially if that meal was a high carbohydrate meal, then that's most likely too low a blood sugar, and that's a hypoglycemic, a reactive hypoglycemic. Some people drop into the 50s. And it also depends on how they feel. Some people, when that blood sugar drops, they feel like off and woozy. And I watched somebody do that. She drank some carrot juice, and her blood sugar didn't really go up. It just went down. It went from in the 80s or 90, yeah, 80s and down into the 60s. And she just like was feeling woozy. So, yeah, it's a matter of how they feel. Some people can feel perfectly fine on a blood sugar of 65. Well, that's not too low. In fact, some of the advocates of a ketogenic diet for cancer say that they want to keep people in the 60s, like that 75 is the highest they want them to go, which is kind of interesting. They want their ranges to be like 55 to 70 or 55 to 80. So it's really a matter of assessing for each person where they are, what their norms are. But if they say they're feeling like woo, lightheaded, woozy, that's what they do when they do those glucose tolerance tests. They not only test the glucose regularly, but they ask the person to monitor how they feel. And I had one of those done, by the way, when I was in my 20s, and they gave me that sugar solution. But I just was monitoring how I was feeling throughout, and then they got to show me what the sugars were. And when I was feeling like I was starting to feel cold and clammy and lightheaded, like I was going to pass out, my sugars got down in the 50s. So that's how you know. Let's see. Okay, let's go to the phone. And Christine has her hand up, and I'm going to put you on speaker.
Hi, Christine.
Oh, hi. Actually, you answered my question about the how long a person should do the glucose testing on their regular foods that they've been eating, and that was my question. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Christine.
Okay. Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. So Christine, and then we have Beverly. Hi, Beverly.
Hey again. Thanks for answering my question before. I do sometimes notice that my kind of like what you're saying, where there's no real spike, it just will go down. But I feel absolutely fine. And so I'm often left wondering, well, was that a problem? If I feel fine, my blood sugar is now lower than, you know, my morning levels have been a little high, and we probably know that's stress-induced.
Right.
And to be expected. But later in the day, once I exercise and so forth, I usually will come down. They haven't been real high. Those morning readings are in the 90s. But they'll often come down to the low, you know, from mid-90s down to low 90s or high 80s.
And that's fine. That's not enough of a drop to be considered any problem at all.
Okay.
You're fine.
And then if I do drop into the 70s, should I assume that maybe there is a reactive
Depends on what you've eaten, and you know enough about the foods, right? If you've eaten a lot of the foods that help to increase insulin sensitivity, then it's probably related with that. But if you've had carrot juice or something high glycemic and then it drops, then it could be a reactive hypoglycemia. And it's not a serious thing. It's not saying, oh, it's a problem, and, you know, having 75 is a problem. It's just saying, it's just giving us a clue that your body's overproducing insulin.
Right.
And that you shouldn't be eating those particular foods.
Okay, right. The difference between, like, this level and this level, it's not like either of them are really dangerous, but you can see
No, not dangerous at all.
Yeah, you can see what your body's definitely doing.
Yeah, but it'll say, you know, maybe you shouldn't be eating that particular food because it causes a hyperinsulin response.
Well, I'll notice it sometimes if I've had fruit in my smoothie and if, you know, but it comes right back to normal again. It's like a quick thing. It's like literally.
I wouldn't worry about that. I wouldn't worry about that at all. You know, and another thing that's a good point because I want to bring up to people, one of the things you might notice as you're testing your blood glucose or as your clients are is that you'll eat something and you're just real curious, so you don't wait the 15 minutes or the 30, and you just keep testing it, and every now and then you get this really high spike. If you get a really high spike, don't just write it down and wait 15 minutes. Take it again immediately, because sometimes you're just catching the normal response. It goes up, it brings it back down, goes up, and you might be catching it just at that split microsecond. And I've had that happen where I go, what? What? I just had, you know, piece of chia seed or a cup of chia seed and my sugar is up to that, can't be, and I'll do it again and it's normal again, and then I'll do it again. So I usually do it, it's if it's real high, then I'll do it again three times in a row, it's perfectly fine, and no, it's not, my machine isn't busted, it was just probably one of those normal physiologic ups. And the same thing you might be catching is a normal physiologic dip while your body's normalizing. So it goes down, your glucagon comes in, brings it back up, and you're fine.
Okay, good. Because, for example, I had an 83 a few minutes ago after having, I had like two different things. I had a green smoothie with some fruit in it, mm-hmm. and then I also had, because I had dinner early, luckily, and I had that delicious steamed veggie blended with some coconut and mm-hmm. a little bit of the sea veggies and so forth, and I thought, oh, I should make sure that wasn't too much sugar. So I checked. It was 83, and then it went up to 98. Now it's down to 82.
Hmm. That's fine. When we talk a drop from baseline, I'm talking 10 or more points. Anything less than 10 or more points, I'm not concerned about at all.
Okay. How about like 15, 20? Is that okay? If you're in the normal range to begin with, under 100 or just slightly, like say 108 or 110, and then it comes down to, say, 93. Would you be concerned in those ranges?
No. I'm not concerned there at all. No.
Okay, good. So as long as you're already in the okay ranges at either end, it's not a big problem. Thank you.
Right, absolutely. And when we say this, is it not a problem? It's not like it's dangerous, but it's a clue.
It's a clue.
It's a clue to look at what you were eating to say, huh, maybe that's stimulated too much insulin and maybe I should watch that food.
Good.
It's all like we're just always looking for clues because it's not black and white. And we're getting in here and analyzing this in a much more detailed way than most practitioners ever do. And the results are phenomenal when you do it this way.
Exactly. Because I really want to learn this. I you know, there's so many people that these issues are creating so many big problems for and expensive
mm-hmm.
drugs and time constraints of having to run to the doctor and all these tests and just such great clues for us to help our patients with.
We're really helping them versus masking their symptoms.
Yeah.
That's great.
Thank you.
Great question. Okay, let's see if anybody else had a question on the web, and if not, and if you have any more questions, I'll take one more question on the phone just to start too. Okay, I'll refresh. Okay, one more question just came in. Tracy, I have a client who's going on vacation and most likely will enjoy wine in the evening. Is there a supplement she can take before bed so she wakes up feeling refreshed? You know, it's interesting. We all want that special thing. B vitamins would be helpful. Because alcohol depletes B vitamins. I don't know that she'll feel refreshed in the morning, but it will certainly help to dissipate the negative effects somewhat of the alcohol. Any kind of antioxidants here, anything that would support the liver, so maybe, you know, some milk thistle, you know, a little tincture of milk thistle, and some B vitamins, that might be helpful. So think about anything that you can do to support the liver and to help replenish some of the nutrients that could affect it. But, you know, it's not going to completely negate the effect of alcohol. And not that necessarily one thing of alcohol is bad, but if they have insulin resistance, alcohol can really wreak havoc on the system. So, yep. And that's it. So we have one last question, and forgive me, but it says David Lotker, but I know it's not David. And
it's
I don't
Eleanor.
Remember.
It's Eleanor.
Eleanor.
Can you hear me?
Thank you. I'm trying to remember all the pseudonyms on here, but I just can't keep them all straight.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. I actually have a two-part question. I have a client that I'm trying to get go through the Be For Be Gone program with me. And, of course, I had lots of questions, and one of the questions is, what do I get to eat? So I got into the recipe collection and the menu planner, and the soups are not cooked. They're raw?
Yeah, but they can be cooked.
Okay, so they can be cooked.
Okay,
so
they can be cooked or they can be lightly heated so that they think they're cooked.
Yeah.
And there are some soups in there that are cooked where we steam the vegetables and then we use the broth from that and we put it in the blender and blend them up and maybe put it over a bed of steamed vegetables with some konjac noodles or things like that. So there's quite a selection. There's a really good collection of, I wonder where I put those. I have a really good collection of slides. I will put those up on the site. I know where they are. That one of my clients that went through it, she hired a cook, a chef, to make her food every day. And so she has pictures of all these different day after day of the amazing, gorgeous things that she ate for a month. So that would be a great thing to show your clients.
Yeah, because, I mean, it looks like, I think the shake, and I need to ask you about the morning thing, and the salad would be okay, but he really wants to have dinner. And I was just wondering if, I know you speak of Mark Hyman a couple of times. He has, you know, a blood sugar solution cookbook. Are his recipes okay on this diet, or you probably
some of them are, some of them aren't, and it depends because he doesn't differentiate between whether you've tested a certain food. So he does have some rice in there, and he does have some quinoa in there.
Okay.
But if your person, is this person a meat eater?
No, but chicken and fish.
Okay, that's meat. So they can have dinner, can be a big plate of steamed or stir-fried vegetables, a salad, and a piece of meat or fish. That's a perfectly fine meal on this insulin resistance program.
Okay, and that's very doable. Now, in the morning, it's, you know, it's either the juice drink or the smoothie drink. And I went, and, you know, you have a slide or a video, I can't remember, of a lot of these protein powders and green stuff. And it seems like you're trying to do a protein powder and a green powder. And I went and looked at a lot of them, and they have, a lot of them have all this extra vitamins in it, like vitamin A, which I really try not to get my clients, because it seems like people are putting vitamin A in everything now, and vitamin A is really not, you know, the woman.
Well,
actually,
most of them, when they say vitamin A, it's beta carotene.
Okay, but still, that's fat soluble, right? And she was saying that the vegan woman was actually.
No, not the beta carotene isn't.
Okay.
Yeah, so beta-carotene is the water-soluble version, and that's what's in most of those supplements. The fat-soluble is pure vitamin A, and the body converts the beta-carotene to vitamin A, but only as much as it needs to, and most people under-convert. So there's really not a problem with over-converting beta-carotene to vitamin A and creating a fat-soluble increase. However, there are protein powders in there that don't have anything added to it. So, for example, the Health Force Nutritionals, they have a brand new one that I absolutely love, and it's called, Mega Green or Mega Elite Green Protein. And it's
green-based. Say it again,
Elite Group, Elite Green Protein.
Okay.
And that is a really good one. Sun Warrior Ormus greens, just pure food. I think the ones that have more of all that extra stuff are the things like the Vega and the vitamin code and some of those, they try to make them like the complete meal kind of replacements.
Okay.
But there's quite a number of them. A Vitamineral Green from Health Force Nutritionals. That doesn't have any added vitamins or minerals. You know, there's nothing synthetic, nothing added. It's just whatever's in the food, whole food based.
Okay. And what was the Sun Warrior one?
Sun Warrior is called Ormus Greens.
Ormus. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do any of them not have stevia in them?
Yeah. Well, the Ormus Greens
does,
and the Health Force doesn't. So the Health Force, if Health Force is the Vitamin Oil Green has no stevia. The Elite Green Protein, they have a mesquite version and a mint version. They don't have any. And I think they also have something called Greener Grasses. That doesn't have stevia. In fact, I don't think any of the Health Force green powders have stevia in them.
Okay, great. That's what I'm looking for. Okay, great.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thank
great
you.
Question.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. I think we're done. I'm going to check one more time. I'm just a sucker for not leaving any questions unanswered. This is the last one, though. I said base. Terry asks, mentioned baseline blood glucose level. Is this the fasting blood glucose level? And I call it baseline versus fasting. I think very specifically of fasting being the first thing in the morning, and baseline being if you're testing before and after a meal, baseline would be what you were before you ate. So that's the differentiation. But the fasting blood sugar would be the baseline for your breakfast meal. And then, Terry, when will we receive bonus materials such as Before Begun recipe book, and when will the orientation videos be? Okay, so the Before Begun recipe book should have gone out. That was supposed to have gone out last week. I mean, you've got the ebook copy of it on your site already, and I'll check in with Scott. But he was supposed to have had that sent over a week ago, so I'm going to write that down, Scott.
Before recipe.
Okay, and then some of the other bonuses. One of the other bonuses was was the business kind of videos, and that should be on the side panel on your thing, and it should say healthpreneur, quote, in parentheses, business, and that's a set of six videos and slides. That's there, and then the Before Begun program will be when we start the Before Begun program. But you've got the blood sugar balancing, and I'm pulling out a lot of the resources from Before Begun to give you with each individual module here. As far as the orientation videos, those have been delayed because I got partially through editing those. Just a few of those that were from the last year's, and I was adding some new slides and just putting those together, and then I had to have the surgery, and I've been really limited at sitting at my desk and doing the editing. So I'm sitting at my desk now for the first time in a week, and it feels good, and I'm hoping that I get to do more of that and get caught up on some of those over the weekend. Next week we don't have a class, just to reiterate. We have a break next week. Our next class is the 30th. Let me go back to the beginning of the slide presentation. See if I can move this up. How do I get there? I'll go to the beginning. It won't let me go back to the beginning of my slides without going through them all. Okay. Okay. Here we go. So our next class is going to be on Monday, September 30th. So we have a break next week, and that'll give me an opportunity to get caught up and get the orientation videos up, and anything else that I may have promised will go through that. And that's it, I think. All right. Have an awesome week. I'll open up the lines if anybody has anything to say. If you want to just say hello and goodbye to everybody, we'll see you in 2 weeks. You've got lots to go on. Expect the next set of resources as soon as I get it to Stacy tomorrow, and then she'll get it done and up and formatted and all that, and you should have that within the next day or two. And I highly recommend that just go and start working with this stuff and working with it on yourself. You're going to see amazing results. So thank you all for being here. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
You're welcome.
Thank you.